Hi everyone. On behalf of the Exchange, I'd like to thank you all for coming to this evening's event. This is the first event of the semester and it's launching us as a new working committee, which is for the first time we're a working committee. And we're also launching our programme events, which hope to engage you in the key contemporary political debates and discussions. The structure of tonight's event will consist of a 30-minute presentation by George Galloway, then 40 minutes question and answers. Then following that, there'll be a book signing of his new book, Open Season, The Neil Lennon Story. George Galloway is former MP for Bethnal Green and Bow. He's a prominent author, journalist, broadcaster and activist, standing at the forefront of the UK anti-war movement following the 2003 invasion of Iraq and the pro-Palestine movement, having founded the Viva Palestina convoys. Without much further ado, I would like to introduce our speaker for this evening, George Galloway, speaking on the topic, No More Wars. Thank you.
Thank you very much indeed for your patience. I apologise for the lateness of my arrival and also for foregoing, as of course inevitably I now must myself, the European football this evening, in which I have an interest, but did not know that when I agreed to this engagement. But you had a choice and you've exercised it in such large numbers in coming here this evening, and I'm very grateful for that, not least because it's been some time since I was speaking on the university circuit in the run-up to the war on Iraq. Meetings like this were commonplace, and every day and every night, sometimes two, even three in a day. And I thought to myself, well, of course, virtually all of those students will have left universities now, so who will come to a meeting such as this? And we'll discover, I'm sure, who, politically at least, in the Q&A, but that so many of you have come is intensely gratifying to me, and I think a credit to the university that it has raised in the minds of its students that the world is round, that what happens beyond Sheffield, England, Britain, Europe is important, and that our country is playing an important role in the various crises that I shall address this evening. Now, I think it's importantly wrong. Some of you may think it's importantly right. But we at least can agree that our country is a significant actor in the international issues that I shall address, which are the principal international issues in the world. It's therefore vital that an informed public keeps to account the parliament and the government, theoretically answerable to that parliament, for the choices that Britain is making in the international arena. I should place my cards firmly on the table. I am lifelong, and before me, my fathers and mothers and grandfathers and grandmothers before me have always hated imperialism. I hate empire. I believe empire to be merely organized crime, dressed up, sometimes in the clothes of religion, sometimes in the clothes of civilization, sometimes latterly in the clothes of humanitarianism. It's my case that empire is about invading other people's countries, killing them, and stealing their things. No more and no less. When I was young, Britain had an empire which was described as being so vast that upon it the sun never set. But as my Irish grandfather said when I told him the teacher had told me this, that's because God would never trust the British in the dark. And I never had any cause to doubt him. The British Empire was one of the most successful exercises in organized crime in the history of empire, which is, of course, long and ongoing. And for a brief period in the 1950s and 1960s, Britain virtually, with the exception of the north of Ireland, completed its withdrawal from its vast empire. And it seemed that the age of empire for us was over. It seemed we had reconciled ourselves to the fact that we are a small island off the coast of mainland Europe in the North Sea and the Atlantic Oceans. We have no right to imagine that the world should turn around our axis. It seemed that our country had decided to concentrate on its own affairs, addressing its own structural, political, economic, social contradictions and difficulties, and that the world would have to take care of itself. Over the last decades, however, perhaps three, Britain has returned to the imperial stage. This time not as the principal actor that it was before, but as the auxiliary of the special forces of the vastly more powerful American Empire, which until the last 8 or 9 years bestrode the world with its power, terrified the world with its power, its hard power, its economic power, and even its soft power, as if we had decided nationally that we couldn't be the school bully anymore, but we'd be the little sneak that ran around with the school bully, feasting on the pickings left by the bully when he was finished. I firmly believe that that's the role our country has taken on, which has taken us back to the imperialist era and has made our country one of the three most hated countries in the world. Now, you have an interest in that, a much greater one than I. You have, I hope, long lives ahead of you. It matters to you in all sorts of ways, even your own personal security, that your country should not be the third most hated country in the world, alongside the United States and Israel, a subject to which I shall, of course, turn. Our role in the long decade of sanctions against Iraq, which ended with the cataclysmic invasion and occupation of Iraq, against which millions of people in Britain marched and protested, but which nonetheless happened and was as bad as the worst prediction that I or anyone else made as it played out. I myself marveled at Mr. Blair's admission just a few weeks before he demitted office, that he had been, he repeated this in front of the recent inquiry on Iraq, that he had been, and I quote, surprised by what had happened in Iraq after the victory of the Allied forces in the war. But he had no right to be surprised. Many people warned him precisely, except where they underestimated exactly what would happen. I myself, outside the gentleman's lavatory, in the library corridor of the House of Commons, with Alistair Campbell trying to pull him away, told him in the starkest possible terms, just me and him in the discussion, that if you invade Iraq in a few weeks' time, the fall of Baghdad, which will inevitably happen, will not be the beginning of the end, just the end of the beginning. If you invade Iraq in a few weeks' time, while there is no Al-Qaeda in Iraq now, none, there will be thousands of Al-Qaeda in Iraq after you have invaded. That the Iraqis will fight you with their teeth if necessary, long after their army has run away. The Iraqi people will fight you with their teeth if necessary, until they have driven you from their country. For Iraqis love their country no less than we love ours. If a foreign army invaded and occupied our country and parked its tanks on every corner, set up roadblocks in every street, smashed in doors, and invaded the privacy of our houses, took the young men away in hoods and tortured them, then piled them naked in a jail, forcing them to commit indecent acts upon each other and videotaping it for the entertainment of the troops in the barracks later. If our country lost, as Iraq lost, 1 million people with a population less than a third of ours, so gross it up, if we lost 3 million people in this occupation of our country, sure there would be collaborators in Buckingham Palace, maybe in the City of London, they'd be out trying to sell them, the occupiers, financial services. But the vast majority of decent people in our country would fight any foreign invader and occupier of our country to the best of our ability. And the Iraqis are not less than us. I told him all of this. I said, once you occupy Iraq, there'll be car bombs, drive-by shootings, suicide bombs. I told him all of this, but he could not be persuaded. And everything that we predicted came to pass. 1 million Iraqis have died, 1 million, on top of the 1 million who'd already died under the sanctions. 3 million Iraqis are living outside their country, many of them begging on the streets of nearby countries because they can't go back to their own. This in a country of just over 20 million. Count up, 3 million exiled, 1 million dead, 1 million dead in the sanctions. That's 5 million people out of 20 or 21 million no longer there in the country. But the hatred, I said to Blair, that you will cascade around the world will be much more serious than anything that happens in Iraq itself. You will make Muslims, 1.7 billion of whom inhabit this earth, you will make Muslims everywhere, including in our own country, hate you, hate us for what we have done. And how right that turned out to be. I said in a speech just after 9/11, when the House of Commons was recalled, that if we approach this crisis the wrong way, We will create 10,000 new bin Ladens. And again, I underestimated. Al-Qaeda now exists in every country in the world, including our own. Hopefully not in this audience, but certainly in our own country on 7/7/2005, we saw its bloody catastrophic results, and we've seen it in many other places too. And that's the principal reason, number one, for us being in the three most hated countries in the world. The second of which crystallized this day on the news, if you have seen it. The Palestinian people had their country wiped off the face of the earth, off the map. Go check the atlas if you don't believe me. Look for a word, Palestine. You won't find it, because their country was wiped off the map as a result of a decision taken in our parliament, in our country, in London, in 1917, when the British Foreign Minister, Mr. Balfour, committed an act unprecedented even by imperialist standards. When, on behalf of one people, us, he gave away to a second people, the Zionist movement then representing just a scintilla of international Jewish opinion, when he gave away to them the land which belonged to somebody else. One people giving a second people the land which belonged to a third people at a time when we did not even possess that territory, even as an imperial possession. It was unprecedented. But that Balfour Declaration, which viewed with favor the establishment of the state that we now call Israel, on top of the bones and the ruins of the country that was then called Palestine, is the second reason. Not just because of what we did in 1917, but because of our unrelenting, unremitting support for each and every crime committed by that state of Israel over the intervening almost one century. Continuing until this day, last week, the foreign minister, former foreign minister of Israel, Zippy Livni, was able to frolic through Harrods without fear of arrest. Though 2 years before, she had had to flee from a military airport in the south of England, just ahead of the police, who were armed with a warrant granted by a magistrate in Westminster to arrest her on suspicion of crimes against humanity and war crimes under the Geneva Convention. She just escaped in time, but last week she was in Harrods. How come? Because the British government, with all party agreement, changed the law purely for Israeli suspected war criminals, so that neither she nor any other suspected war criminal, and by the way, the suspicion of war crimes does not come from me, but comes from Judge Goldstone, a Jewish Zionist supporter of Israel whose family live in Israel, who said that there was a prima facie case that during the 22-day war against Gaza over Christmas and New Year 2008-2009, Livni and Olmert and Barak and other ministers and officials, prima facie, were guilty of war crimes and crimes against humanity. When Mahmoud Abbas went to the United Nations about 3 weeks ago, 4 weeks ago, to ask the United Nations to recognize a Palestinian state on just 22% of Palestine and the worst bits of it at that, the vast majority of countries in the world agreed But Britain and the United States both made clear that they would veto in the United Nations any such move. So the disaster that has overcome the Palestinian people and our central role and ongoing role in it is the second of those reasons for our third place in the Most Hated Nations League. But the third of them is more important either than the wars and occupations in which we're involved or the Palestine question, and it is this. Our country and its close ally have propped up every puppet president, every corrupt king who rules the Muslim world almost without exception from one end to the other. Indeed, none of them could have stayed on their thrones, in their palaces, for any length of time, if not for the weapons we gave them or sold them, the political and diplomatic support we afforded them, the money that they needed if they needed it. All of these tyrants, some of whom are now falling, and we have the grotesque spectacle of British and American politicians trying to claim credit for revolutions that overthrew dictators that they supported until the last hour of the life of those dictatorships. Sarkozy was selling weapons to Ben Ali, the deposed dictator in Tunisia, 1 week before he fled from the airport with his ill-gotten gains. Gaddafi was being sold British weapons, his soldiers being trained at Sandhurst, his intelligence men, God help them, receiving training from the British security services. The London School of Economics was on its knees begging for money from Gaddafi and getting it, and no doubt other universities were too, until weeks before the revolution in Libya occurred. And where is Ben Ali now? Maybe Gaddafi's there too, skulking in the den of iniquity, our best friend in the whole Muslim world, the kleptocratic, bitter dictatorship that they call Saudi Arabia, where women get lashed for driving a car, the crime of driving a car in 2011. You get lashed in public. A country that cuts people's heads off in public squares, on television, the blood spurting into the sand. A country where there is no liberty or freedom of any kind, and never has been, and never will be, is our best friend in the whole Arab and Muslim world. We sell them guns. Oh, how many guns? Uncountable guns. Tens of billions of pounds worth of guns. We sell them torture equipment. We support them politically. We bring their king to stay at Buckingham Palace. We roll out red carpets. And we ask the people of the Muslim world to believe that we're in favor of liberty and democracy when we are supporting the dictators who crush liberty and democracy and keep those dictators in power. And if they fall, we'll quickly move in to try and ensure that what comes next is just as favorable to our interests as what went before. These are the three reasons. I could go through every country in the Muslim world, if you'd like, and describe its dictatorship and our relationship to it. Most people in Britain don't know that, never think about it, don't care about it. But every Muslim cares about it, because it's them that are under these iron heels of these dictatorships. And they know, even if our people don't know, the role our governments have played in their misery. That's why it's vital for your generation to try to find a way for Britain to exist in the world unhated. To try to find a way that Britain can be a global citizen rather than an arch criminal in a criminal enterprise. Some of you, I can tell, think criminal's too strong a word. Have you any idea how much of Iraq's wealth has been looted by British and American oil and gas companies? Have you any idea of the tens of billions of dollars stolen from Iraq during this long period of occupation? As I said, I could go through many, many countries and describe in detail, and will in Q&A if you would like me to. But just in case you thought that war was going out of fashion after the bloody disasters that we have been through, or because of the fact that our countries, us and the United States, are now effectively bankrupt, just in case you thought that a country that can't afford to keep its old age pensioners warm in the winter time has probably not got enough money to go around the world setting fire to other people's countries, then you haven't been paying attention to the £48 million a week we spent bombing Libya over the last 6 months. You haven't been paying attention to the ongoing march to war against Iran, which took another decisive step in the week with the cockamamie plot to kill the Saudi Arabian ambassador in a Washington restaurant, a plot laid at the door of Iran. Our politicians haven't learned the lesson. And do you know why? Because they didn't pay a price for it. The only person in the country that made them pay a price for it, and in the election at the time, was me in 2005 in Bethnal Green and Bow, when I defeated a New Labour war champion. Everywhere else, they were all more or less safely returned. And if you don't pay a price for disastrous mistakes, why would you avoid those mistakes in the future, especially if there's money to be made even from the mistakes, as indeed there is in plenty? You know, in a democracy like ours, imperfect though it is, the people get the politicians they deserve because they voted for them. And they didn't vote for others whom they might have voted for. The expenses scandal, I digress only briefly, proved that you can get away with almost anything in British politics. Hazel Blears in Salford should be in Pentonville Prison. She's responsible for cheating the British public and taxpayer of more than £100,000. She didn't go to Pentonville Prison. The people in Salford sent her back to the House of Commons. So, in the remaining years that God gives me, it's my intention to try and rouse the understanding, whether on my TV programs, radio shows, newspaper articles, speeches like these, to try to rouse especially young people into demanding better from their political leaders and a better role for Britain in the world. Thank you very much indeed.